Ann Arbor's Big Show.
Good evening. This is what's happening in your world tonight.
Bringing you sports in a big way on your way home.
I have a personal announcement, though. I'm placing a personal bounty on the head of
Jim Tressel.
He's the coach and chief punk on it.
Buckeye
team.
Ooh, welcome back. John Bacon on Sports Talk 1050 WTK. You are listening to Not Off the Field. I keep trying to say that, but it's not true. The Big Show on Mondays, of course, with Mark Copeland. Mark, lighten up there. Good knowledge on CNN and how it started.
Very CNN, impressive. Yeah. Ted Turner wanted news when he wanted it. So he said, I guess I'll have to do it.
It's a great line by Toni Morrison. If there's a book out there you want to read that has not been written, you've got to write it.
Exactly.
There's a station out there you want to watch that doesn't exist, and you're Ted Turner. Go ahead and make one. So
yep.
That's what he did. Ben Bach, of course, super intern there from Eastern Michigan University, and our special guest this hour, Greg Dooley of mvictors.com. Welcome, Greg.
Welcome. Hey, guys. How you doing? And, boy, it is an honor to be here with the great historian John Bacon.
Well, you're too kind, and my listeners would agree with that, that you're too kind. I do, of my 5.5 books, 2.5 of them, if you will, two and a third, I guess. One's on Fielding Yost, The Legacy of Champions, Blue Eyes, The Story of Michigan Hockey, and, of course, the Bo book. That's 2.5 books on Michigan history, Michigan sports, and so on. And yet, I, on your website, constantly find things I did not know, things I've not even come across peripherally in my research at the Bentley Library and elsewhere in interviews. You found a ton of gems I had no idea existed. And tell us a few about your, first of all, the site is mvictors.com.
Yep.
It started in 2006, and you're not quite up to Brian Cook's level of hits. He's no doubt the man in this field. He said also, I think, it's got the most hits of any college football site, mgoblog.com, that is. But anyway, mvictors is doing very well. There's a great camaraderie amongst the bloggers, I've noticed. You guys all link to each other's sites. Your site focuses on Michigan sports, University of Michigan, sports history. Let's talk about a few of your great finds.
Sure. Well, yeah, I run a post series called eBay Watch, and what I try to do is take a recent auction on eBay of a particular piece of memorabilia, go back, look at the piece itself, and then dig into some of the things that were going on with the piece or with the player that was involved or the season through history, and then that kind of opens up a window or a lens into some interesting stuff. And I've done just about every decade of Michigan football in particular. I've covered some element of the seasons in that decade. And some of the most interesting things I found, it's always interesting when former players' rings, championship rings, show up. There's always some unique stories around there. I came across an early 1980s ring that bore the name McCartney on it. And the seller said it was a salesman sample of a McCartney ring, and of course Bill McCartney, the former assistant coach and defensive coordinator, and later Colorado coach, was on that team. And of course, one thing led to another, and I got a note from his wife saying, "That's not a salesman sample. That is my husband's ring." So that took a little bit of an interesting twist.
So, in other words, when Bill McCartney was an assistant coach on Bo's staff in the early 80s, before he went on to Colorado, where he won national titles, but then started, of course, Promise Keepers. So he's been a high-profile guy, to say the least, over the last two or three decades. So the theory was it was a salesman sample. That's what the guy was claiming on eBay, who was selling this ring. The wife writes you and says, not a salesman's sample. It is my husband's ring. How did the guy selling it get a hold of it?
I don't know. He was a professional dealer, though. It wasn't just a guy off the street who found it. Now, Mrs. McCartney, and her name escapes me, gave a story about how he lost it. I believe he lost it on the beach, I think he lost it twice, actually. He lost it at the beach, and then he lent it to, I believe, one of their son, who showed it around class, and somehow it didn't get returned. But
ooh,
she's convinced this is the ring. Now, what I don't know, I tried to contact the person who bought the ring and the seller, and you can probably guess that we didn't get very far with that.
Calls were not returned, is my guess. Is that accurate?
You bet.
So what's interesting about these finds is there tends to be some tinge of scandal to some of these things, or disappointment. The person might be broke and has to sell whatever they've got. So there's one story for you. Has the ring been sold or not?
The McCartney ring?
Yeah.
I don't know. It hasn't shown up again, but it did find a buyer when it was sold. And there's been rings through the 80s. And one of the amazing things about the internet is every time I've listed an item that's tied to a player in recent years, inevitably someone who knows the player or knows the situation gets in contact with me. I've had a case where a ring came on in the 80s, and someone actually called the guy who you know, it was his ring. It was very interesting. But most of the stuff I do is actually not recent. It actually goes back to Fielding Yost and back to the Harry Kipke days. Those are the items I think I find most interesting.
Hmm. To finish up on the ring, though, I do wonder what kind of person would buy a ring that has Bill McCartney's name on the side, a team you obviously did not play on. I can't understand the incentive there, I guess.
Well,
it's like stealing someone else's high school yearbook. What does it mean to you?
Okay, well, I mean, people all often buy game-used jerseys that are signed. And
that's different.
Okay, explain to me how it's... I mean, it's a piece of history. It was worn in a game, and the ring, yeah, it's an award. I mean, I can see that. It's someone's personal possession, but it's... When the 1997 championship ring came on, I'm sure someone out there, you know, was interested in buying a piece of that championship.
Yeah, okay, fair enough. That's true. Certainly, the jersey thing I get entirely, the game-worn, signed jersey. Me and Joe Green and the Coke ad, for crying out loud, there's a classic for you.
It's a little creepy, though. I mean, what are you going to do with that ring? Are you going to wear it? And then, well, did you win that? You know, did you earn that? Well, no, I bought it on eBay. So that is a little creepy.
Just saying.
Yeah.
All right, Fielding Yost memorabilia. What have you found there?
Well, I am actually working on a piece for Brian Cook's excellent preseason guide that he puts together. He calls it Hail to the Victors. This year will be 2009. And last year I did a piece on Harry Kipke and the Depression-era Wolverines. Very interesting stuff. But this one starts, I'm going to look at the 1909 season, which, of course, will have its centennial this year. And it was a remarkable year. It was the first official battle for the Little Brown Jug. Of course, the jug was lost in 1903 after the game. So this is actually the first time they played for the trophy. But digging into that season, there's a lot of great things that happened. But at the end of the year, the team met for the team picture for that season. And after digging through some of the daily articles at the Bentley Library, they actually elected their captain, a guy named James Joy Miller. He went by Joy. And this was in December, early December. And they elected him the captain of the 1910 team. And a few days later, a scandal broke. And it turned out that there was evidence that Miller, he was registered, but he was improperly registered as a student and didn't take the required classes. He attended some classes, but not enough, clearly a violation of what they were trying to do. And one of the concerns at the time, as you know, John, was, you know, the professionalism of players. They were trying to make it a collegiate sport, limit guys for playing for 6 years. And this was clear violation of that. And the Daily broke the news, I believe, but it rippled through to the Free Press, which was obviously, Detroit was a huge metropolitan area at that time. And on Christmas Eve, it hit the New York Times. And this was a big deal. Miller was eventually kicked off the team officially, and I believe he never came back to school. But interesting stuff like that, which you don't find too much or hear about.
Well, what's amazing is you don't, because I have studied that team. I've studied that era. The first, it's called Legacy of Champions. Angelique Shangalis, the Angel of the Big House, did a great section on Fritz Kreisler. Chris McCoskey about Bo. Bob Wanowski, of course, Wojo did the forward to it. I did the Yost section. So I poured over the stuff fairly well and never came across this. So how you found this stuff is really quite amazing. How did you find that stuff?
Well, it started with I actually wrote about this on my blog about a year and a half ago, I think it was. I found an eBay item from 1909, and I just started out with some basic research, and this New York Times headline popped up, Scandal on Michigan Team, and that's how it started. I went from there.
It also shows, by the way, whenever you get into the history of this stuff, one of the great lessons you learn repeatedly is there is nothing new under the sun. The same problems they had in the 1910s and 20s are the same problems that college football is dealing with now, short, perhaps, of steroids. Back then, it was called rum. That was the only real, that and cigars, I guess, the only real drugs of any question at that time. Also, 1909 is interesting, and I know you know this, but the listeners might not. Michigan leaves the Big Ten for 10 years, and most fans have got no idea about this. The most successful team by far in the Big Ten has been Michigan football as well as all sports. And this team left from 1907 to 1917, was not in the Big Ten. This 1909 game with Minnesota becomes so much bigger because that's one of the last games Michigan plays against a Big Ten team. Amos Alonzo Stagg prohibits teams from scheduling Michigan during the stretch. So there's one last grandfathered game you got to play. So the whole nation was watching that game. And as I understand it also, is the 1910 game, I think, where the forward pass Stanfield Wells was first popularized. There's some debate as to who started it, be it Pop Warner, Newt Rockne, or Yost, but Yost has got a very strong claim for being the first guy to use the forward pass effectively in a game, and it would have been 1910 up in Minnesota. But there's some more fun facts for you on that one. Of course, Amos Alonzo Stagg and Yost hated each other's guts, so anything Stagg could do to get Michigan out of the Big Ten, he was going to do. But it is amazing stuff. And during that 10-year stretch, Michigan can't play its main rivals, Minnesota and Chicago, most of that time. So whom do they play? They play teams out of the league at the time. Notre Dame, Michigan State, and Ohio State, which are today, of course, Michigan's three greatest rivals.
You bet.
So other great finds you've got.
Oh, boy. I found an old jersey. Actually, it wasn't auctioned on eBay, but a authentic game jersey, speaking of game jerseys, from the early 30s that they actually tied to a player named Norm Daniels, and he played for Kipke. In the research, I found out that Mr. Daniels is, and I believe was, and I believe is still alive.
Wow.
And his family contacted me, and he's not very lucid, so he couldn't, you know, speak to me or anything like that. But I was interested in finding out more, and he sounds like he's doing, you know, okay. But his family wanted the jersey back, and again, we could only do so much there. But to find out he was still with us was very amazing.
He must be pushing 100.
Yeah, 101, I think he was when I last updated that.
There you go. That's good stuff there, of course. The 30s, a fascinating decade. Two national titles, followed by the 1-7 flop. Thanks to the Willis Ward controversy, you know a lot about that.
I do. Oh, well, 1934 is an amazing year, and they say, you know, history is written by the victors. And once again, you don't hear so much about the bad stuff when you go back, and you know, we don't write about the bad times. And what you know, what most people know about 1934 is that's when Gerald Ford was the captain, MVP of the team. Mm-hmm. But they, what I feel is the worst season that Michigan's faced, 1-7 on the field. But the one win involved an incredible controversy with Georgia Tech, where Georgia Tech would not take the field if a gentleman named Willis Ward was playing for Michigan, who was a star on the team, who happened to be African-American. And, boy, John, documentaries, movies should be written about this incident. I've heard Arthur Miller, who worked at The Daily, tried to get involved. We obviously have a future president involved who was his roommate for road games that season,
right.
Gerald Ford. Eventually, Ward did not play. Michigan, that's the one game they happened to win that year. But an incredible story. And just us talking here, we're just scratching the surface of the potential of that. But
the 1909 story about Joy Miller, the elected captain, who was not, in fact, a student, I had no idea about this one. The Willis Ward story I know quite a bit about, and it's in Legacy of Champions and so on, that he and Ford, big deals made of Brian Song, of course, in the late 60s, the first black and white roommates in the NFL. But 35 years earlier, Willis Ward and Gerald Ford already did that on Michigan's campus, of course. So it's not that big a deal, you'd think. Willis Ward and Gerald Ford remained very close friends the rest of their lives, and Willis Ward ended up being a circuit judge, I believe, mm-hmm. in Detroit. And Gerald Ford would leave his senatorial campaigns on the west side of the state to come to Detroit and campaign for his old friend, Willis Ward. Those guys were tight to the day they died. And that is one of the great stories of Michigan athletics. Fielding Yost is against him playing. Fielding Yost's dad fought for the Confederate side. We shouldn't be too surprised by that, perhaps. Although he did show some redeeming qualities later on in his life, it must be said. And Willis Ward ended up being one of them after the fact, sadly. But Willis Ward, I interviewed Gerald Ford about Willis Ward, and he said he's one of the finest men you will ever meet. And he's already gone by then, unfortunately. It's in the late 90s. But Gerald Ford could give you chapter and verse about Willis Ward. On that note, take a brief break here. When we come back, we'll talk more to Greg Dooley of mvictors.com. More great historical pieces on Michigan athletics, as well as some current stuff on Michigan football, hockey, and basketball. Give Greg a call with your own historical questions at 734-998-1050, 734-998-1050.